Final case of the day is United States against Pittman. Mr. Mitchell.
Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm Gregory Mitchell, representing Mr. Gerald Pittman. Your Honors, the issue here is really one, and that's the very handed or heavy-handed nature in which Mr. Pittman was prosecuted and sentenced. And essentially, as I outline in my brief, Judge, he goes from being identified as a small-time dime bag distributor of cocaine on the street to be selected and targeted by the government, to be involved in an undercover, to be converted into a confidential human source, to be put back out on the street, and then to be sentenced with an advisory guideline range of 30 years to life without any opportunity for negotiations or anything else for a sentence less than that. These arguments and the circumstances to which Mr. Pittman...
But that was the deal he made.
Well, Judge, there was no deal in this case, and that was clearly pointed out to the government from the very beginning. Mr. Pittman was taken from his home in the morning, was brought down to the government's office, was questioned extensively, was signed a waiver, and was told repeatedly, but you have no deal. You have no deal, but you have
no,
an
no.
opportunity.
Yes, I understand. The deal was... The deal was that he was going to, you know, he was going to take his chances. He was going to, that the government might file these additional charges and the government, and it might affect his sentence. He knew what he was getting into. Presumably he had reasons for doing it. He didn't have to.
Well, Your Honor, I clearly accept and recognize, and I'm sure Mr. Pittman knew, that he was in trouble. He knew that. And he knew he was in big trouble. And he knew that the only way that he could possibly help himself was to cooperate with the government. He understood that. But I reaffirm, Judge, there was no deal. And that's really the problem here, Judge. That's really what the issue really is here. Because at the time...
He didn't cooperate, though.
Well, the question is this, Your Honor. At the time that the government arrested him and sent him back out on the street, they understood, essentially, all of the criminal conduct to which Mr. Pittman had been charged and had been involved in, some of which was orchestrated by the government, clearly. The concern was, what was it...
He was going to sell a gun to someone who wanted to use it to shoot someone? Was that...
Pardon me?
That's cooperation? I mean, that's...
The purpose of the gun offense, Judge, that was another undercover extension of getting Mr. Pittman to try to sell to the cooperating person that the government had sent to him as he had been making those transactions to now try to get a gun. So that was all part of the undercover investigation as well. So it wasn't that Mr. Pittman was doing something outside of the government's control with respect to what they knew he was doing that was led to his cooperation. So what my point being is that the government knew the full extent of Mr. Pittman's criminal activity, what he was going to be charged with and what he was facing at the time that they arrested him, questioned him, and began to have him cooperate as an informant. The only issue here, Judge, is what changed? What changed to go from a person that you're now going to use as a cooperating witness, knowing the full panoply of his criminal conduct, to a person that we will not work with?
But his behavior when he was cooperating, and you don't argue, I don't think you argued it was entrapment. This behavior, the willingness to sell a gun to someone who says he wants to shoot someone, that perfectly sensible ground for the government to file the additional charges, isn't it?
Well, Judge, it wasn't that they filed any additional charges. They charged him with everything at the very beginning when he was brought
before. Well, I know,
before.
But renew the charge, whatever you want to call it.
The real issue here, Your Honor, is that Judge Koukouras, an experienced judge, as you know, had all of this before him. And clearly, his misconduct for breaking the agreement, as you would say, Judge, he gave him obstruction with respect to the gun. He basically gave him, with respect, the punishment for that. In fact, at the conclusion of the sentencing hearing, Judge Kokoris agreed that everything that the government had alleged that was an appropriate aggravating factor.
They just got an extra 2 years, right?
Judge, that's significant.
Yeah, I know, but what he did when he was cooperating was also significant.
And the point that for the brief, Judge, is what was the motivation? What was the motivation for the government for that additional 2 years? What was the reason, given that all of the relevant conduct was there? Judge Kokoris carefully considered everything, even the correctness of the sentencing guidelines and the pre-sentence investigation, and yet he concluded that given all of the factors that this court has directed and the Supreme Court has directed him to consider, that a 96-month sentence was appropriate, given the factors, and he made it very clear. The question becomes, what was the motivation? What is the extra 2 years for? And if it had only been the extra 2 years, Your Honor, then maybe that's not the issue. Maybe there was no evidence or even a presumption of vindictiveness. The only difference was is that they had engaged in a plea negotiation for 10 years and Mr. Pittman rejected it, sort of like in Cooper. Mr. Cooper had engaged in plea agreements. There was offers made by the government, and there was a clearly disconnect. If you don't take the plea agreement, we're going to enhance you. You're going to get 20 years, but we'll offer you 15. There's no evidence in this case, Judge, that there was never any offer of anything whatsoever. There was simply a dogged determination, 30 years to life. You're going to get 30 years to life. And that was what was presented to Judge Kokoris. And he listened intently. And he concluded, notwithstanding all of that, notwithstanding every indication of relevant conduct, that given this man's background, given his age, given the history of his criminal conduct, and even given what he has done in this case, the obstruction, the gun offense, and the like, the appropriate sentence in this case was 96 months. What we have here is that notwithstanding all of that, the government took that discretion away. After they gave it to the court, presented their entire case, presented their entire sentencing, entire evidence, they took that away and came back and says, no, we're going to go forward. We want you to plead, or we want to try you on what we already know to make sure that the statutory minimum was going to be applicable here. And even then, the record indicates they didn't argue for the statutory minimum at the second hearing. They argued again for 30 years to life. 30 years to life, Judge. And the question becomes, what did he do to deserve that kind of heavy-handedness, and whether or not that heavy-handedness raised the presumption that there was something else going on here? There was something else going on underneath the government's zeal to make sure that Mr. Pittman served 30 years to life for what he had done with respect to running away. I think the cases that I cite in the brief, Judge, gives you, although there's nothing directly on point, but they give you an instance of where this court and the Supreme Court has said, we need to be careful. North Carolina versus Pierce, it basically says we have to look at presumptions when there's a more severe sentence is imposed the second time around. In this case, Judge Kokoris had no choice, and he points that out. We're concerned when the only thing that changes from the first to the second time is when there's a more significant sentence. There's another Supreme Court case that I also point out, and that's in Blackledge. And again, it talks about whether or not there's a realistic likelihood that there's something else. Vindictiveness is going on. There's a presumption raised here. Again, what we have to see is what's underneath the covers. We understand, Judge, that the law is very clear. Very clear that unless you prove entrapment, you're going to get everything you deserve. Unless you prove that clearly there was some manipulations in the charging or something else, even in that situation, if your presumption and your guilty behavior doesn't overcome that, you're going to get what you take. The real concern here, Judge, is that unlike in the Cooper case, where Judge Manning basically said, we're not going to sentence Mr. Cooper because I'm not going to consider the relevant conduct for the conspiracy. If the government wants that additional punishment, they're going to have to try him and ensure he was tried and he got that second sentence. That's not the case here, Judge. That's not the case whatsoever. Nothing changed at all. Every charge was present. Now, in their brief, the government sort of throws in this issue of the felony with the gun.
He has. We want this guy to have a felony with the gun. So just in case it happens later with the gun, we want to have the opportunity to enhance him later. To me, Judge, that's a disingenuous argument because that was not the charge that took him to the statutory minimum. It was only the drug charges, the quantity of drug charges that were submitted to him through the government's undercover that he didn't plead to that took him to the statutory minimum. So it wasn't the gun charge. It was not that. That was not the issue here. I would ask, Judge, that you consider this with respect to the over and heavy-handed.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Judge.
Ms. Morrissey.
May it please the Court, my name is Megan Morrissey, and I represent the government in this matter. Appellant, asked rhetorically what changed from the time period that defendant first agreed to cooperate with the FBI to the time he was charged. And the answer is a lot changed. The defendant committed significant obstructive acts.
But that isn't the issue. His complaint is about about this strange procedure. I haven't seen it before, by which the government had him plead guilty and be sentenced on one count, reserving the right to proceed on the additional counts after he was sentenced on that count. He accepted. That was the deal. But what were they? Were they frightened that Judge Koukouras would give him a really light sentence? I can't think of any other motive for the government's proceeding this way.
Your Honor, I think that's right. I think that's exactly where the focus in this case should be, and there's no evidence of any vindictiveness by the government in connection with that part
of
the proceeding.
You're not responding to my question.
Unfortunately,
the government... I said I can't think of any other reason except fear that Judge Koukouras might give him a light sentence.
Well, unfortunately, the government doesn't control the counts to which defendant pleads guilty. That is the sole, exercise of discretion by defendant and his counsel. The government can't force the defendant to plead guilty to any particular count. Defendant exercised a strategic plea in this case. The defendant exercised a strategic plea in this case. He pled guilty only to count one, a count that carried no mandatory minimum, but he was admitting the factual basis underpinning the other drug counts. And it's abundantly clear from the record why he did that. He was pleading his way around the mandatory minimums.
Right. And the government was worried about that, was worried that Judge Koukouras wouldn't give him a high enough sentence.
The characterization of whether or not the government was worried about it, I'm not sure that's
asked. Do you have an alternative explanation?
Well, I think when the defendant opts to plead guilty to only some counts of an indictment, the government is under no obligation to just dismiss the rest of the counts. The counts remain outstanding until...
I just haven't seen this done before. That's what bothers me.
Well, I think it's often not done because the government...
Has it ever been done before?
I think the Cooper case is one instance in which it was done, Your Honor, where the defendant exercised the right, just as they did in this case, to plead guilty to less significant counts. The remaining counts were outstanding. And in Cooper, unlike in this case, the government followed up that plea in sentencing by filing additional counts and additional sentencing enhancements. That is not what happened in this case. The government took no steps to change the status quo. There were outstanding counts that had been in place from day one of the case, and we elected to proceed on those after the sentencing. And the defense has offered no evidence of any improper motive underpinning the government's decision to proceed on those outstanding counts.
What would be his motive to plead guilty on one count rather than negotiate a deal on the whole bunch, on all the counts?
I think his motive, Your Honor, would be to plead guilty to a count that had no mandatory minimum, hope he'd be sentenced to a term under the mandatory minimum, and hope that the government would walk away satisfied. And that's not what happened in this case.
But he had no protection.
That's correct, Judge, but I think it's a gamble that the defendant took, and unfortunately it's one that he lost. I think, as appellant pointed out, it was the government's position from the get-go that the guidelines...
Is this common? Someone pleads guilty to one count and the other count's just sitting there?
I don't believe it's common, Judge. I believe at least in my brief experience in the office, even blind pleas are often negotiated so that the defendant is pleading blind to the most serious count so that this isn't a problem. But in this case, that's not what happened. The defendant strategically attempted to plead around the mandatory minimum term of imprisonment applicable to the other counts. You know, the district court characterized the government as having a good faith disagreement with the sentence that was originally imposed on count one, and that the extent of that good faith disagreement is certainly well supported by the record. There are extensive 3553A factors indicating substantial aggravation in this case. As I explained, the defendant had actually admitted to conduct that ordinarily would carry a 10-year mandatory minimum, and defendant at sentencing then conceded he had committed a firearms offense of which he did not stand convicted. In addition, of course, the government had an interest in trying to achieve some type of uniformity among similar types of cases. And so for all of those reasons, the government elected to proceed on the remaining counts. And as the district court found, that was a wholly appropriate exercise of pretrial prosecutorial discretion. The defendant finally raised in their brief the question of whether or not there a rebuttable presumption of prosecutorial vindictiveness should apply in this case. The Supreme Court and this court have extensive...
Would the district judge have to accept such a plea, or could he say, I'd like to resolve, I don't want to sentence this person, what were there, seven counts or something?
Seven counts, correct.
I don't want to sentence him seven times. I'd like any guilty plea to be deferred to encompass all the counts.
I think that is probably within the district court's discretion. That obviously didn't take place here, but I suppose that would be within the court's discretion.
Perhaps more to the point, the question is why the district judge didn't defer sentencing on the one count to which Pittman had pleaded guilty until the other counts had been resolved.
I think the answer to that, Judge, is that the parties were okay with proceeding to sentencing on count one. This wasn't a topic that was...
It's odd for the judge to be giving sentences over and over again in the same case.
Agree, Judge.
The normal rule is that one indictment leads to one sentencing proceeding at which the judge comes up with a total package appropriate in light of the defendant and everything the defendant has done. And it's very difficult in this case to see any reason for departure from that norm.
Well, Judge, I think the fact of the matter is that we weren't sure what was going to happen with the remaining counts following the guilty plea to count one.
You weren't sure what was going to happen. You knew that they were going to be pursued or they would be dropped.
Well, yes, Judge, but there may have been a trial. There may not have been a trial. We weren't sure. There was some indication at the time of the change of plea that the defendant intended to proceed to trial on the gun count, on count seven. So I think... perhaps to sort of try to speed things along, perhaps to encourage some type of resolution as to the outstanding counts, that may have been why the district court agreed to proceed to sentencing on count one. Again, I don't think this happens very often, but Cooper is certainly one instance where this type of circumstance unfolded. But again, to respond to the defendant's final point regarding a rebuttable presumption of vindictiveness, this court's precedent, the Supreme Court precedent, clearly indicates that no such presumption should apply in the pretrial stage. As we've just been discussing, this case...
Did Judge Kokoris think that he might have to sentence a second or additional times?
I think the...
What was he told when he...
At the time of the defendant's plea to count one, the court was very much aware that the remaining counts were outstanding, that the government was free to proceed on those counts. I think the district court did an excellent job of making sure that the defendant himself was aware that that was a possibility.
But sentencing is a big production, isn't it?
Yes, Judge, especially
probation,
in this case.
Service and everything. So they had to do a second, did they have to do a second investigation?
They did not
a
do
recommendation
one in this case.
About, didn't they?
They did not do a second PSR in this case, Your Honor.
But they had to submit something the second time, didn't they?
They may, and I apologize, I don't recall, they may have submitted a very brief statement of the guidelines, but because the second plea and second sentencing occurred in fairly short succession, a full-blown PSR was not required. Mm-hmm. So for all of those reasons, as I've just outlined, Your Honors, the government respectfully requests that this court affirm the sentence imposed by the district court.
Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement. And Mr. Mitchell, we appreciate your willingness to accept the appointment in this case and your assistance to the court as well as your client. The court will be in recess.